This week on Art on the Air features fiction novelist Jatinder Koharki discussing her new novel just released, Against the Odds of Tradition. Next, iconic Chicago fashion designer Paul Sisti, whose designs are a fusion of art and fashion while maintaining a level of simplicity and elegance. Our spotlights on LaPorte County Symphony's Remember When Rock Was Young, the Elton John Experience on April 18th.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight from the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra, and she's the executive director, Emiliana. So she's going to tell us about two things that are coming up here in April, next concert and another thing. Emily, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thanks so much for having me. I just always love talking to you too.
Yeah, we feel the same about you, Emily.
Thank you.
Go ahead and tell us what's happening with your... This is your final concert of the regular season,
yes,
so tell us
I'd
all about that.
I'd love to. Thank you. Yes, April the 18th. That is a Saturday at 7 p.m. Your LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra is going to be joined by Craig Meyer, who plays Elton John in a production called Remember When Rock Was Young, the Elton John Experience. So this is the preeminent Elton John impersonator, and it's a fully staged costume production with your LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra backing all of those great Elton John songs that everybody knows and loves. Philadelphia Freedom, Candle in the Wind, Benny and the Jets, a lot of his Broadway hits. So we're just super excited to bring this show to the LaPorte community. Carolyn Watson did this show out on the East Coast with Craig a few years ago and wanted to bring it to the LaPorte County community. And so we're very excited to host them and to bring this very interesting, different show to the community.
So, Emily, will there be lots of costume changes?
I believe so. Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes. And if you go online, you can see some of our, there's some still shots of the show on our website, and you can see some of the very extravagant costumes. And there will also be a white baby grand on stage, which is going to be very cool. And also there's some backup singers and a little band that travels with Elton John. And so it's going to be a really cool show, and we're super excited.
Who's providing the piano?
One of our lovely board members has a white baby grand, and we were, you know, discussing it at a board meeting, and she said, well, I would love for that to be used for the show. So I just scheduled the movers to take it from her house to the Civic and back.
Yeah. Well, then this seems like something you're doing, like, what was it, last year or a year before, you had the magical mystery tour, the Beatles thing.
That's right, the Beatles, yes. Yes, so this is a similar kind of operation as far as, you know, they have the orchestra charts and the orchestra backs up the group that comes in. And so it's hearing the songs with full orchestration, which is something that you don't often get to hear, especially live.
Right.
Sounds so exciting.
That'll be great. That's on April 18th.
And that's right.
So you have another thing coming up. And of course, the actual event happens in the fall, but you have an audition. So tell us about
that. That's right. Yes. So Hoosier Star auditions are the following Saturday, April 25th. from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Presbyterian Church of La Porte on the corner of Kingsbury and Indiana Avenue there in La Porte. And auditions, signups are now live online at lcso.net on our website. We encourage everyone to reserve your audition slot in advance. We will accept some walk-ins at the end of the audition day, but to be guaranteed an audition slot, please register online. It costs $20 to audition. You need to bring your own accompaniment, whether that be your pianist. There will be a piano available, or accompaniment on your phone. We'll be able to hook that up to a Bluetooth speaker and come on out and give it a shot. We'll be choosing 5 youth and 5 adult finalists for the grand finale Hoosier Star, which will be held September 12th, 2026. A chance to sing on stage with the La Porte County Symphony Orchestra and cash prize winnings of $1,000 for the winner and $500 for the runner-up.
So, Emily, is James Neary involved in any way as a judge or a mentor?
I don't believe so this year, but he will be performing his winning song at the end during voting tabulation. So he will be there and performing that incredible number that you did.
Yeah,
it was Somebody to Love.
Yeah. Oh, Somebody to Love. Oh.
Yes, yeah. So we're excited for that. We always have the past winners back to sing during voting tabulation to give the audience a little treat and give them another chance to wow us with their winning song.
So Beautiful. Next season, I'm sure you may not have anything yet. We'll have probably another interview to kind of share what that is.
Yes.
But I'm sure that's in the talking stages right now. And I don't know if you can hint at anything without giving away the whole store.
Yeah, we're very excited. I'm waiting for a couple more puzzle pieces to fall into place. But we hope to announce the new season at the Elton John concert on April 18th. We have some very exciting programs lined up. I can let a couple things slip. We're going to celebrate the 200th anniversary of Beethoven's death with some Beethoven program in March of 2027. And we have a very exciting program for November for the opening subscription concert. One piece that for sure is going to be on that is Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, which is a very, very cool piece for orchestra. So we're excited about the season and a couple more things to fall into place, but I'm planning to announce it at the April 18th Elton John concert.
And is there going to be a slot for you to perform at next season?
Oh, I don't know. Possibly.
For people in our audience, Emily is a phenomenal vocalist. I mean, I knew she was a professional vocalist, but the first time I heard her just knocked me over.
And I'm
very serious about that. Well, really quick, in our last few moments here, recap what you have with the concert.
Yes, Saturday, April 18th, 7 p.m. at the La Porte Civic Auditorium. Tickets are available online, lcso.net. And they will also be available at the door for walk-ins. Doors open 1 hour prior to concert. And come on out and enjoy a very exciting evening of Elton John with your La Porte County Symphony Orchestra.
Executive Director Emily Giannis from the La Porte County Symphony Orchestra. Thanks for coming on Art of the Year Spotlight and sharing the last concert of your season.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Emily.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Ember Forge Consulting. With end-to-end expertise in learning strategy, design, and implementation, Ember Forge turns your organization's knowledge into impact. To learn more, visit emberforgeconsulting.com. Art on the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners? Email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. We are delighted to invite you to attend a screening of the new Ken Burns, Sarah Botstein, David Schmidt PBS documentary, The American Revolution, in celebration of the 250th anniversary of the United States. Lakeshore Public Media, along with Indiana Humanities, are hosting a viewing and discussion at Valparaiso University's Hare Union Ballroom on April 22nd at 3 p.m. Discussions will be led by facilitators and a light snack will be provided. To make your reservations, go to Lakeshore Public Media website and click on the event graphic. Don't miss this very special event.
This is motion picture and television orchestrator, conductor, and Fine Line Music Service founder Greg Jamrock, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM. and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Jatinder Koharki to Art on the Air. Jatinder moved from India to America when she was 10 years old. She earned a Bachelor of Science in Management and an MBA. After a 20-year career in consulting, she transitioned to one in client relationship management and also embarked on a parallel journey to build a career in writing and publishing. She is the founder and owner of Book for Every Nook Publications, LLC, with a goal to self-publish her debut women's fiction novel, Against the Odds of Tradition. That novel was released March 1st of 2026. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome to Tinder. Very wonderful meeting you.
You too as well. Thank you for having me today.
Our audience always wants to know your origin story. And while in the introduction we touched on some of that, we wanted you to tell it. How you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Jatinder.
Great. So I, as Esther mentioned in the introduction, I moved to New York at the age of 10 and grew up in Flushing, Queens, and went on to upstate New York to get a bachelor degree. But before I got there, I started to get interested in writing and wrote some short stories and poems and stored them on floppy disks, which got somewhere disappeared somewhere in mom's, you know, millennium 2000 year cleaning process. But I was always interested in writing and read a lot of books as a teenager. After college, fell into consulting, really enjoyed it, loved it, thinking creatively and working with different personalities, and stayed there for about 20 years. And I had written my first manuscript about 10 years ago as a way to, you know, relieve stress from the workload and everyday life and put it away to keep climbing the corporate ladder. And about 3 years ago, I dug it back up and made a change in career direction and decided to pursue it and published it. And it's out there now as of March 1st.
Mm-hmm. So coming to America at 10 years old, Do you remember your young time in India and what was the household like? And were you writing then or telling stories or?
Yeah, no, I when I was in India as a young child, I remember a lot of stories being told. I remember one afternoon or multiple afternoons to me. It was just kind of all rolls up into one session where my grandfather, my dad's dad, basically told my brother and I his entire life story from, you know, being chained to after he enrolled in the army at the age of 15, lied about his age, like so many people of his generation, really wanted to fight in the war. And was brought home in chains because he refused to leave the army and to, you know, just all the different kinds of things he did. He was also a very creative person. And yeah, the family was always full of stories, you know, good, bad, funny, serious, and grew up listening to stories. And that's, you know, that was how I got interested in just all the books that opened up to me after I moved here and started living the American dream and became an American kid in New York. And just, you know, just books are my world.
So let's talk about some of the other aspects of your career. You know, we touched on it, but what type of consulting you did? What work did you do in those areas before now you've landed kind of now as a full-time author? But, you know, what types of things were you doing?
Yeah, so I was helping my clients think about, you know, just their businesses. And that was the creative process that I enjoyed. It wasn't, you know, as clear cut as here are the things we have to do. How do we do them? It was really, how do we think about our business? And I started off in the healthcare industry, which has always been very complex. And trying to think help my clients balance their care for the patients and the folks who they were actually caring for in healthcare versus the business of healthcare, because you can only help people if you stay in business at the end of the day. So trying to help balance the human side with the business side, and that was where the ambiguity was high and the creative, you know, you had to be creative about how to help people in all different aspects of life. So that really kind of helped me stay in consulting, and it really helped me appreciate, and I've been told I need therapy for this, but it really helped me appreciate the business of insurance, not only health insurance, but all kinds of insurance that we need in our lives, that we choose, or that we're supposed to, you know, we're required to have, because it really helps us figure out how safe we are and how safe we want to be. And that's how I help my clients thinking about their customers and how safe they wanted their customers to be at the end of the day. And that's where, you know, the human side of it really was what appealed to me. So that's what I really enjoyed helping my clients with.
And you did that for about 20 years, you said?
I did that for about 20 years. And then I switched to, about 3 years ago, I switched to focusing more on building relationships with my clients, my employer's clients, specifically the company that I work for now. And not so much, you know, the actual on the ground project work, but more helping them grow their own footprint and helping them understand their own markets, competition, and how they can continue to grow their business to help their customers and stakeholders.
Is that still in the health industry?
No, right now it's in a different insurance industry.
Well, and you're still doing that now, or are you completely out of that?
I am, yeah. So I am working full time while writing.
Excellent. Well, it's like actors say, oh, I have my acting job and my real job. So
yeah. Well, yeah, it's kind of similar where I consider the two both my real jobs. I take both right. very seriously.
So tell us the process of how you came to actually write Against the Odds of Tradition. I mean, is this something that was a process for a while? Maybe you sketched out ideas in your head and everything like that and then decide to actually develop it into a book, or, you know, tell us the process of developing it.
Yeah, I mean, considering I wrote the original manuscript about 10, 11 years ago now, I don't remember what originally brought me to this idea, but it was part of it was related to my family. I do have a family member. It's in the dedication for the book as well. I do have a family member who was widowed at a young age, and she had three kids under the age of 10, and this was in the 80s. She was living in a village in India. And traditionally, you know, widows, there's still over 40 million widows in India today, right? They're known to be widows on their own, not having a family. So in my family, we, you know, all rallied around her and helped her start her own business. And she did the best she could, you know, help from the family came as well. But that story stuck to me because there are so many cases of women being abandoned after they're widowed because they're an economic liability, unfortunately, given a country where there's a lot of poverty at the time, especially. But, you know, here she was raising three kids on her own with help from her family when she needed it, but really standing up, starting her own business and making her own money as best as she could. And that was really inspiring to me. And I wanted to tell a story that really, frankly, has been told in different ways, but not from this particular perspective of someone who has basically been told there's no role for her in society. There's nothing for her in society, but she still fights to find her life and live her life. That part of it really appealed to me. So I kept coming back to the story. So I don't know originally what brought me to it, but that's what kept me coming back to it. And I picked it up again after 10, 11 years. I didn't want to write something new. I wanted to tell this story particularly for that reason.
So in the historical stories that your grandfather was telling you, did that work its way into your novel as well? Is any of this from, you know, your personal history?
Probably very little. I think probably some elements that I may have forgotten, you know, if I had to define where they came from, maybe I can't remember, and they might subconsciously have made their way in there. Just stories I remember hearing from, you know, the time back in the 30s and 40s and 50s and what it was like in India. And yeah, I did a lot of research as well, but I think some of it might have made it in there from hearing personal accounts of what life was like.
Right. Well, and also the historical aspect of it is set in mid 20th century in an incredible transition period for India. You know, the period of your book covers that, and maybe explain that historically, what that period was, where it went from the one thing to the next thing.
Yeah. So typically in that era, we fixate on World War II and the war itself, you know, in the 40s. But what was happening in India at the time was even in the 30s, there was a growing anti, you know, colonial movement to free India. And it really started to grow until 1942 when it became an official Quit India movement. And, you know, Britain was battling its own wars in Europe by then, by 1940, right? It was the bombing by Germany, and it had declared war on Germany by 1940. So there was a lot of, and India was the crown jewel. It was still a colony that was owned by Great Britain. So there was a lot of conflict between how to be good British subjects, because a lot of Indian men fought in the war. They actually went to Europe to fight on the side of the Allies in World War II. But at the same time, they were loyal to their mother country, India. So there was this confusion about, you know, India is a British colony. We're Indian, but are we British at the end of the day, or are we really Indian but not British? So I think that conflict rose to the surface in the 40s, especially when they said, okay, we need to be independent. We can't be ruled by foreign rulers anymore after seven centuries of, you know, rulers from other parts of the world who having control over the country. And as World War II concluded and Great Britain, you know, had to make that choice between have to rebuild the country, they had lost a lot of lives and money. So it was losses and very, very deep, very high costly losses. And so that combined with the losses of World War II and the, you know, the encouraging aspect of the Quit India movement, it came to fruition in 1945, 46. And then they said, okay, Britain's going to quit India. And 1947 was the year that they did it. But in the aftermath of that, what Great Britain did before they officially quit India was they divided the country into two countries, India and Pakistan, which the third part of it on the east became Bangladesh, but it was originally Pakistan.
East Bengal.
And so they divided the country along religious lines. So people who were, and my maternal grandmother, actually her family moved from Pakistan to India because they were not Muslim. So what happened was if you're not Muslim, you're going to move from Pakistan to India. If you're Muslim, you're going to go from India to Pakistan. That was along the border states. And that's where my family is from, Punjab, the border state that that's next to Pakistan now. And so that caused a lot of chaos. I mean, millions of people went missing that were never recovered because people just, you know, started to, they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know what was waiting for them on the other side. No matter what your religion, if your family was in Pakistan for generations, that's your home, regardless of whether you are Hindu or Sikh or Muslim. So the aftermath of World War II in India had a very different situation than what we think about when we think about Europe. And that's where Mina's life really, you know, the story, that's a big part of Mina's life and her story as well.
Well, it's very poignant in the book where, you know, you keep mentioning the white of the freedom fighters and then the white of Mina's widows wear. And her perspective of it making her so angry because here the men are fighting for freedom, but she knows that color represents no freedom to her. And she's worried about what's going to happen if the freedom happens. It's going to be worse, she's talking about, for women. So it was so beautiful that you added that richness to the story. But you know what, I had to keep filling in, and I wonder what I would love to, because I read something that you wrote about how you purposely left out a lot of the color and flavor of India, including on the cover of your book. So can you talk about why you did that? Because as I was reading, I was filling that part in for myself, actually, as I was reading.
Thank you for asking about the cover. I wanted to keep the cover simple because I think it really speaks to Mina as the main character, as the protagonist, and who she is as a woman. And she is pretty simple, just given, starting with the circumstances, right? She literally has to be simple, first of all. She has to wear white all the time. She can't have any jewelry. She can't have any color. She can't have any, you know, creativity in how she looks. She has to have her hair tied all the time. She has to wear white every single day. She can't even wear heels. She has to wear flat shoes. She cannot look attractive. So I didn't want a lot of color and a lot of the, you know, typical Indian settings and images that you think of to take away from who she really is, forced to be as a person. And I also didn't, and this is probably my personal experience when I see a lot of books about stories that take place in India, and the covers are very, you know, they have a lot of Indian images, patterns, shapes, and colors. Mm-hmm. It makes me think that, okay, this is going to be a book that you need to have a little bit of context and relation with the Indian history to be able to relate to the story. And a lot of them have turned out that way. Not everyone, just most of the ones that I've read. So I didn't want that to be the impression that readers would get when they would look at the cover that, okay, this is a story about India, about Indian culture. So I don't know if it's really for me or if I'm going to be able to relate to it. So I wanted to keep it simple. The yellow of the cover represents the blooming of Mina's life because that's really what happens, you know, despite all the odds of tradition against her, her life ends up blooming. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then the two O's that are the golden in the O and the odds and the tradition and the O in tradition, they represent the wedding bands, mm-hmm. you know, so kind of putting some symbolism in there. So I just, I didn't want it to look like every other cover that would send similar impressions. It was really just, it's simple because Nina is simple. She has simple needs, simple wants, and it's really about her life blooming and not so much about India and its culture.
Right. The story starts almost historically, almost 100 years ago. And does this culture, I mean, and you told us an experience that you had with the one widow that your family helped with. Does this still exist in India right now, the same types of things? Or is that starting to erase, we like in the modern era, like in 2026 here, is some of the same challenges for widows exist?
They do. So, you know, that's why I mentioned in the book as well that there are 40 million widows in India today. And, you know, there are women who are either living in ashrams or temples or in some situations where they might not be with their families because just like it was 100 years ago, they wear white all the time. They're not really considered a member of the family once their husband passes away because they are seen to be not to not contribute anything. And so that still exists. There have been changes along the way. It's been almost 100 years. There definitely have been changes. And more women have been getting remarried and, you know, life is changing. But at the same time, it's an interesting culture where the two exist in parallel, where you have a lot of modern, you know, 21st century ideas and ways of living where women have more freedom and they've advanced in the options that they have. And coexisting with women who are still abandoned today because their husband died and they're of no use to their family. So the two exist in parallel. It's a very interesting situation.
Well, you know, I think we ask if you had a section of the book that you were prepared to maybe read just a sample for us so our audience can get a sample of your writing.
Of course. Yes, I picked a scene towards the middle. Do you want me to set up the scene or should I?
Yeah, set
sure.
it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the scene from the train station and it's towards the middle of the story and Meena is preparing to leave her village to go to Bombay with her family. It's a short scene, so hopefully it'll only be a minute or two. As Henry and Robert handled the luggage and ticketing process, Meena held on to the boys, clinging to her dress as the thickening crowd moved in all directions. Every British family in neighboring villages was on a mission to get to Bombay and out of India as soon as possible. After securing their tickets and luggage, Henry and Robert each picked up one of the boys to keep them from getting lost or trampled on the platform. Meena stayed close to Henry, clutching a piece of his suit jacket between her fingers as they made their way through the crowd. The boys refused to let their mother out of their sight, their eyes fixed on her as she smiled to keep them calm. It worked until they heard a commotion behind them. Meena turned to see a group of Indian men yelling in fury tear through the station gates. Her heart raced as she and everyone around her broke into a run to board the train as fast as possible. The train whistled. It was time to get on or get left behind. Meena saw people jump or desperately toss a child into the first open door within reach. Meena turned once more to see men far behind her swinging swords and knives without looking. She turned back and realized she no longer had hold of Henry's jacket. Scared to her bones, Meena ran as her eyes searched for her family and an open door to jump through. She spotted Henry at the door ahead of her, handing Will to Robert and then jumping on himself. She saw his expression change from relief to panic as it dawned on him that she was not on the train. She waved a hand and yelled, "Henry," but her voice got lost in the noise of the crowd and the violence approaching her from behind. Meena's eyes finally met Henry's as the train started moving. She was getting closer to the door, but not fast enough. "Henry," she yelled again. "Meena," he yelled back, "hurry." Meena tried to run faster, but could only move as fast as the crowd around her. From the corner of her eye, she saw Will and Richie at a window inside the train and stifled a sob of relief. Her children were safe. Will spotted her and gripped the bar on the window as his eyes widened with panic. He pulled Richie back from the window, trying to keep his little brother from watching their mother disappear. Henry clung to the door with his arms stretched out as far as possible, but out of reach. When she saw him preparing to jump off, Meena held up her hand and shook her head. Through blurred vision, she caught a glimpse of her husband hanging halfway out the door, arms stretched out towards her, the color disappearing from his face. Her eyes found Will one last time, his hand grasping the bar, his silvery gray eyes overflowing with tears as he and the train disappeared.
Wow. And that's from Against the Odds of Tradition with our guest today, Jitender Kawarki. Oh my gosh, it's such a moving, I remember that now. And that was just something so frightening about that at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we communicated, you said you're on your second book. Is it a continuation of this or is it in the same direction but completely different?
The second book is not a continuation. It's also women's fiction, but it's more contemporary and it's a completely different story. Although I have thought about, you know, at least two possible sequels to Against the Odds of Tradition, given some of the things that are left unsaid or, you know, not necessarily tied very tightly.
And that you just started that process? I mean, do you have an idea when you might be completed on that one?
I actually started writing that book last year, so I'm about halfway through. I'm targeting next year, maybe hopefully next spring, next summer for the release of that book. So in the works, we'll see how it goes.
So are you planning on publishing other authors or is the publishing company for your exclusive use?
Right now it's for my use, but if an opportunity arises to help other authors publish their works and help them get into the market, then I would definitely welcome that opportunity.
Out of curiosity, away from writing, what do you like to do for fun?
So I'm an avid chess player. I love playing chess whenever I can. And in the winter, my husband and I like to ski. So we like to try out different ski resorts. And we're pretty active. So summers are usually, you know, where can we go hiking or where can we go, you know, walk around and learn something new, see a new town. So we take about two or three trips a year to go skiing, hiking, do some active things. And then, yeah, I love reading, obviously. That's why I didn't mention it at the first thing, because I'm like, oh, it's a given. I read all the time. And but yeah, I love chess and I love cooking. I try to make as much food from scratch as possible. I'm actually going to try making my own bread for the first time tomorrow. See how it goes.
Baking, that's great. Well, we just have about a minute left here, so we want to give you a chance to tell how people can find your book, where they can find it, and then if someone wants to reach out to you, either website or any contact information.
Yeah, the book is out on Amazon. They can look for my name, Jitender Kawarki, or the title, Against the Odds of Tradition. They can also go to my website, jitenderkawarki.com or bookforeverynook.com. Either one will work, and they can reach out to me directly from the website. I'm also on social media, LinkedIn, Substack, Pinterest, Instagram, and Facebook. So whichever works for them, they can reach out to me.
Well, that's great. We appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and reaching out to us to share your book and your writing. It's been a real enjoyable read and very interesting, the historical fiction, kind of a view that maybe some of us aren't even aware of the issues that were 100 years ago and even present. Our guest today was Jitender Kawarki. Her book is Against the Odds of Tradition. And again, you can find her online, Facebook, and many other places, but you can find it by her name and on her picture on our website. You click on that and it'll take her to the website. Jitender, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your book.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on your first novel.
Thank you.
This is Janet Davies, formerly of ABC7 and now the Dunes Arts Foundation, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Paul Sisti to Art on the Air. Paul is a legendary Chicago-based fashion designer known for creating elegant, simple, and artistic clothing featuring the fusion of art and fashion. A graduate of the Ray Vogue School of Design, he has had his work featured in the Chicago Tribune, Chicago Sun-Times, and Women's Wear Daily, and he has dressed notable names like Patti LaBelle, Jackie Jackson, and Cheryl Lee Ralph. He uses fine fabrics and architectural silhouettes with artistic and dressmaker details. He creates modern sportswear, luxury separate statement pieces, which are true classics. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Paul. It's very, very wonderful seeing you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to see you, too. This is exciting. Boy, you did a great job writing that bio for me.
Well, thank you.
Where did you get all those words? See, you know, thank you.
You're welcome.
You know, all that stuff over the years. Go ahead. You tell me, what was your question? I know I was preparing for this one.
Okay. What our audience always wants to know is your origin story. I always like to tee up by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Paul.
Well, I'm not sure we can get to the end yet, but the beginning, I was in Indiana, South Bend, Indiana. So I don't know if you know South Bend, Indiana. Notre Dame is there. But, okay, so I'm 15 and I'm gay and I have gay friends. And what do? You can be a hairdresser. You could be an interior decorator. You could be a florist. No, Paul says, I'm going to be a fashion designer. So I came, I moved to Chicago when I was 17, lived by myself in 1977, and went to school and learned my craft, which, you know, I've seen it go from one thing to another now. You know, you said, well, get from one point to the other. Well, that was the beginning, going to school. But it was such a great era of time because people would get dressed and everybody would go out every Friday night, Saturday, every night of the week, there was somewhere to go. And you had to have different outfits. Everybody had to have on a new outfit or whatever, you know, so. But that's how I started, by going to school, and I was an artist. I mean, I realize now at 66 that I'm an artist. So, and that was one of the, well, no, I still use the same media. I produce garments, but they really have an artistic feel. So I've decided I'm an artist. Does that make sense?
It's true sense. Yes, it is true. So, okay. So before 15 though, Paul, what was the household like? Was it a creative household? And I mean, it's just so interesting. Was there any fashion? Were you very aware of how
very
you were dressing?
Italian, half Italian, half Italian, half Polish. So, you know, Italians, all we do is sit around, drink coffee and want to look good. So I guess that could have been part of it. And of course, my mother, who never wants to take any credit, you know, because she's a big time Leo and thinks, you know, that she didn't do anything. So I constantly have to say, Mother, you know, it's because of you, because there were certain things, I think, you know, back then that you did. Fashion rules, you know, that you had to follow. Oh my God, it's getting to be spring. Well, you better pull out some white pants and a navy blue blazer. Winter, you know, she'd have beautiful coats with a fur coat. The trends, you know, so I guess I followed trends when I was a child, you know, because I was born in the 60s. I saw all this stuff happening. I mean, the world was changing like crazy, you know? So you were like with it or not with it. And I decided to be with it, I guess.
It's so true. Some of the fashion looks from the 60s informed everything for me.
Everything. Janis Joplin, look, Janis Joplin with the feathers in her hair and the fur and the whatever. And, you know, and men with their long hair and David Bowie. And so, everything was, you know, and then it got into that disco era. And, you know, we lived to dress. You just wanted somebody to look at you and say, oh, sparkle. Well, now they what? Sparkle with their pajamas at the airports, you know? I mean, what happened? But I see it changing. No, I do see it changing. But back to when I started, see, the reason I wanted to, because I guess I looked at these designers like Halston and Yves Saint Laurent and, you know, people that were what's his name? Oscar De La Renta. Well, in my life, I met some of these people that were big icons to me. And being in Chicago, there was fashion everywhere. There were boutiques on every block was a boutique. Every block was a boutique. So you could be a designer and go in and do whatever. And you know what? I took advantage of it. And I'd walk around everywhere with my garment bags. Everywhere.
Well, yeah. Chicago's so visually beautiful with everybody who's walking down the street. You've got a fashion show
beautiful.
All the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what life is about, isn't it? They say, you know, life is a stage or you're, what are they? Something is a stage, you know, so be prepared. What did Chanel used to say? Oh, wear some lipstick. You never know when destiny's going to have a come knocking at your door.
Speaking about destiny, so at 17 in Chicago, talk to us about destiny.
Oh, wow. I mean, you can only imagine 1977, 17 years old, living alone, gay. I mean, you know, that was more important to me, really. So my school, I was there most of the time physically, but mentally, not so much. But as I got out and whatever, I mean, I won an award for whatever. And, you know, but what they wanted to teach me, like now I sit here and go, God, what was your problem? Why didn't you want to make a bias striped dress? Why didn't you want to make a plaid, match your plaids? You know, these are things you had to learn. So it was basic principles, which I followed through. And later, later as I had to learn my craft for what I was making, because I became a designer. I had to make a collection. Then I had to find people to work for me that would do the sewing, you know? So that was always, you know, an adventure, you know? But I did it and I found people and, you know, things change. And then my job became something different, you know? Then I had to run these people getting these orders out and going and doing the shows in New York all the time. And you'd go and you do the shows and meet all these crazy buyers from all these stores and do all these things, you know, and try to make everybody happy. And oh, that was tough.
Paul, do you still have the jean jacket from, because you were singled out for that jean jacket at Magic Marketplace in Las Vegas. Do you still have that jacket?
You know what? Okay, I'll tell you that little story. You want to hear that story?
I love that jacket. Yes.
It's not. Oh, well, the denim.
Yes.
Was it a denim jacket?
It was.
Well, okay. So we had to make, we were given a project, and it was by a jeans company called Nudie Jeans. Well, they were very expensive jeans from like Neiman Marcus, and it was a whole big bundles of stuff. Well, put it together. So we put it together. Mine was kind of like, I don't know, rockabilly or something. I don't remember. And it was a cute dress with a little flip and these puff sleeves and whatever it was. So So then I had to learn how to do that because I put that into my line. So I had a seamstress. I always had good people work for me. I think it was Lamb at that time. And she would cut the fabric, stitch the fabric together, cut it, bias, cut everything. So we reproduced it. Actually, you know what, Esther? I think I have a dress here. Come over and try it on.
I definitely will. That was a beautiful sleeve that you
The sleeves were like a leg of mutton sleeves. But, you know, and this was like 15 years ago.
It's got a beautiful pleat that made it so much more better than a leg of mutton sleeve, really.
Because I had good people. Thank you. I had good people that worked for me that I could do that, you know? So now I kind of simplify things a little more and just put a little more paint on it.
Well, Paul, tell us about how fashion has changed during your lifetime. You started in the 70s, and of course, fashion has changed. And
that's
a good question. Now we're in a quarter of a decade into the 2000s.
45 years.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that whole thing.
Okay. So it's only my thinking, you know, so I can only tell you the way I see it. And all these people that I had respect for, they're all gone now. And every time I see these new people running the fashion houses like Valentino, Yves Saint Laurent, I go, who the heck is that now? And I'm looking at these designers and I go, God, I could take that job, or maybe they could hire me, you know? And then I look and they're all like, in their 40s, you know? And I say to myself, I go, you know what, Paul, look at yourself when you were in your 40s. What did you do? Well, I was doing that. So I was living the dream. I didn't realize it, but how things have changed. Well, I mean, I think everything is, then we get down to the economy. So it's like this, you see a beautiful jacket, you can see a beautiful jacket for $25. The next beautiful jacket you see is $25,000. So there's like this no middle in between, if you know what I mean. I mean, I don't know if you follow any of that. This is my concept, because, you know, prices are just out of control. You know, $1,500 for a pair of slacks, who can afford that? Well, although years ago I was taught you buy one or two really nice pieces and that's all you wear all year long, you know, but these kids, the young kids, oh, they got to get a new dress for this. They got to get a new dress for that. But then they don't think, well, what am I going to do with that dress later? So things changed. And you know what? You have to adapt or not adapt. I've had to let myself adapt because my customers were always like this. Well, color doesn't match exactly right. Oh, okay. Well, why don't you stand over there in the light and look at it? Maybe it's better. And then they go, oh, yeah, you're right. You know, get out of my face already. I had to do that a lot, you know, teaching people about stuff. But I think it got so relaxed with fashion, you know, and then the whole thing, like with this, with the nude things, come on, really? Do we need to see Gwyneth Paltrow's, the whole side of her body? Did you see her dress? It was. I mean, like all out, you know, and then she does that. But these young kids, when they do it, it looks good. All I say, I guess, age appropriate. As you get older or more seasoned, you know, you learn not really much matters, really. You can wear what you want and do what you want. But I'm waiting for a renaissance of new fashion, of fashion again, which I'm seeing in the collections and stuff, you know, because who needs another hoodie? Anybody need another hoodie?
Well, I was going to ask you while you were commenting on that, you must love watching the red carpet and, you know, comment on that. I like the Oscar dresses. Now, some of them for the older.
Yeah, I like to see what they wear and go, oh, you know, but I don't want to be a critic because you know what? They're the ones that have the jobs. You know what I mean? And the reason I watch the Academy Awards really is because I like to see what they nominated. And then I like to see whatever it is to see if I can find the exact moment when that person, you know, gets that award, you know, why they got that award. You know, it was like when Cate Blanchett won for Blue Jasmine, and at the end, and you just see her like shake her head, and she's like batshit, like, oh, that's what that 2 hours was I just watched, you know, or Begonia, you know, Begonia. Did you see that? You know? So I don't know. I digress. See?
The fashions, you were right, and you kind of touched on it with Gwyneth Paltrow.
I think they're all wonderful. I mean, anybody that has to do that, except, okay, some of them didn't look so good. I'm going to tell you, you know, like Goldie Hawn, she's adorable, but I don't know. And the other one that was kind of like that was, I don't know, with their fashion, it has to be appropriate. You know, Sigourney Weaver came out. She looked magnificent, you know, but she's always looked magnificent and she's always held her, you know, her style. Well, it's about style. These young kids, they don't know. They say, oh, come out there, wear that dress. Oh, what is that? Oh, it's a jewel hanging over your ass. Oh, well, that's kind of interesting. Yeah. You know, and you know, when they have bodies like that, forget it. I mean, they're all cute, just all cute. If you're young and you have a career like that, then you can afford fashions. What can these other kids do? You know, it's hard. It's a hard thing to crack. But style, I think, is important, you know, and the young kids want to show that they're different, you know, things they like, things different. So.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM on WVLP, 103.1 FM. I saw that coloring book with your design sketches for Purple Rain.
Oh, thank you.
And then they showed the outfit and your mixture of like silks and leathers and wools. I mean, it's just so luscious and wonderful. So are those all the materials you still like working with or what are you working with now?
No. Well, first of all, because silk, which it was predominantly silk. I mean, my first collections were in silk. Because I could find, it's whatever I could find. So I could find silk. Okay, it was silk. And I mean, I like the drape of it and different things. And then Indian fabrics. Oh my God, I had beautiful fabrics from India. And you would just, you know, have to wash them because they were, you know, on the, what is the Ganges River. So, you know, fabrics. And it was just, now I digress. We're talking about my fashion from that.
Use those Indian fabrics in your fashion?
So I fell into whatever it was that I was doing, like the painted silks. It was just phenomenal. I mean, I didn't even realize how much I was doing and orders and painting. Okay, well, then after that, I've always been good at finding like an item. Like one of my best items ever was a black bias cut dolman sleeve flared dress that was in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. It was in their catalog, and it was the biggest selling dress they had. My last order, in the end, I had about 1,000 of these dresses, but it was like right before 9/11. So they almost could have canceled their last order, but they didn't. So I had this big check. Okay, big deal. Well, then I found other things. Like I started doing suede, and I started doing pig suede. Well, okay. How many colors do people want? Every color in the rainbow. Every color in the rainbow. And then once they go through those colors, well, then what did they want? Then it was perforated suede. So I had the perforated suede. It could go. I'm always good at discovering Well, I'm always good. I haven't discovered yet. You know, I'm looking for my pet rock again, I guess. But and I think I found it with what I'm doing now, because I'm infusing the art into my fabric, which, being in Chicago, this was a big thing, you see. Being in Chicago to be a designer, well, you're competing with the people in New York. Well, I mean, me, myself, they go, oh, well, did you ever intern with anybody? Oh, no, Paul couldn't do that because I was just as good as they were. That was it. You know, whoever the big people were, I'm just as good as they were. So that got me through, you know, whatever it was, into the new millennium. But changing the fabrics was always a good thing, you know, because if you're in New York, you could walk out on the streets and just get fabulous fabric. Right. That wasn't in Chicago. So I could take the fabric, I could paint the fabric, I could do whatever. So actually, the Midwest, Chicago, we had a lot of fiber artist designers that were here. I mean, we did have quite a few. But
great resources. I mean, like back in the 80s, there was Tanner Leathers. I mean, that's where I went shopping all the time on Roosevelt. So
I would, this is Paul. Nope. I can't do these people because my other one down the street is going to be using them too. So I had to go to New York and I had to find all these things, you know, and part of being in business is forging friendships with people that you're working with, you know. And I had a lot of textiles. The one you're talking about from the coloring book, those were all from France. I had those were viscose because, you know, well, and then now whatever we have with this tariff thing is just, you know, tearing up anything, you know. So basically, you know, for me to be able to get up and make something that I love, whatever it is that I felt, oh, you know, with whatever I did with this painting and put it out there, I think is good enough for me at this point in my career. Shipping out all that merchandise and having all those orders that I had, you know, it's a lot of responsibility, you know, it's a lot of responsibility. And people really don't care that much anymore. They don't care what they wear. You know, they all say this. Well, I don't know. Nobody else is going to dress up. Oh, okay. You know, so you go in your, you know, your track suit and whatever, you know. No, I think overdress, there's never too much as overdressing, as I can tell from your glasses, Esta. You know, there isn't. But what I've decided now in my career, rather than, you know, I was in New York all the time in this traveling, you know, and I said, I don't even want to travel now. I don't want to get on an airplane. Every time I watch the news, it's something wrong with the airplanes. So what for me in my life in the fashion is I'm drawing it to me. And maybe, you know what? Maybe there's somebody that'll see my things on QVC, you know, a buyer and go, oh, you know, can you duplicate that? But, you know, the art to wear is really, you know.
That structured jacket that you have that you do in various wools, that is such a beautiful design. So
try to find wool, yeah. But try to find wool.
But that would work in denim too. It really would.
Denim, yeah. Well, I learned to grab fabrics. Well, years ago with that stuff from France. So we're talking, you know, 25 years ago, whatever it was. I mean, you know, I'd have hundreds of yards of a certain fabric, you know, certain linens or whatever. I remember one time doing the shows in New York. A lot of them were at the Javits Center or whatever it was. And somebody's sitting there looking at, you know, to writing her order and stuff. And she goes, And she gets up and she walks away. And I said to my rep, I go, what is it? She says, well, some other line has the same fabric and their price is different. Well, what the hell? I mean, what do I know? You know, and I only did what I could do. And Dana, my rep, she was so good. Well, we had a really good working relationship probably for about 20 years. And I think that's important in, you know, a fashion career. You know, you have to find a customer and know where to go with that customer. But, you know, I don't know. Did we drift off of the subject
what's inspiring right now?
I mean, I think really looking at the new collections that are coming out, some of these designer things and some of these looks, and what's inspiring me really is me saying to myself, you know what, Paul, you really like that jacket a lot. So just pull it. I mean, I can't reinvent the wheel. This is what I always said. I can't reinvent the wheel. I can't reinvent the wheel. Years ago, they had at Marshall Field. So that tells you how long ago they had an open call. Okay. So they picked like everybody but me. Like, why didn't you pick me? Why didn't you pick me? And whatever it was, you know, and she said to me, well, what is it that inspires you? I said, well, you know, a lot of times if I have a beautiful skirt and I sell it at market and I sell them, I try to do another one because that's, oh, well, you're inspired by money. Hello. Hello. What am I supposed to say? And then the other thing is you go like, oh, it was because the snow was going and they were riding in the sleigh and, you know, you know.
Well, anyway, Paul, we're going to have to wrap it up there. We appreciate you coming on and sharing your whole art journey. You can find him on Facebook. Just do Paul Sisti. That's S-I-S-T-I. And even if you do a good old Google search, you can find out more and more about him. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your whole arts journey.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for the conversation.
Oh, you bet. You bet. Okay. Keep me posted.
We'd like to thank our guest this week on Art in the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Mary and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.